Hello and welcome to Rules-Based Audio, a Lowy Institute podcast. In this series, we're exploring the rules-based order, a concept that is ever more prominent in debates about how the world works and how it should work. My name is Ben Scott, and I direct the Institute's Rules-Based Order project. In this episode, we'll be looking at the war in Ukraine and international law. I'm delighted to be joined by two highly credentialed international lawyers. Fleur Johns is Professor in the Faculty of Law and Justice at the University of New South Wales, Sydney, and Visiting Professor at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. She's the author of four books, as well as Hashtag Help, The Digital Transformation of Humanitarianism and the Remaking of Global Order, which Oxford University Press will be bringing to all good bookstores later this year. Eve Massingham is a senior research fellow with the School of Law at the University of Queensland, where she focuses on how the law constrains and enables autonomous functions of military platforms, systems, and weapons. She's the co-editor of Ensuring Respect for International Humanitarian Law, which was published in 2020. She has also worked at the International Red Cross and served as an Australian Army Reserve officer. Eve, Fleur, welcome.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
Fleur, if I can go to you first. Russia's invasion seems to vindicate the old maxim that might is right in international affairs. In fact, it's hard to imagine a more flagrant violation of national sovereignty, territorial integrity, and the prohibition on the use of force. Does it spell the end of the rules-based order?
My short answer is no. But everything hinges on what one means by the rules-based order. And you yourself have written about this. So, as you have said, it's a term that's come to signify, in large part, the collectivization of the use of armed force after the Second World War, although it's a term that really only flourished later on. And the legal and institutional arrangements that were put in place to try and ensure that people didn't resort to armed force to resolve their disputes without first turning to the UN or arguing their case in a particular way by reference to, say, principles of self-defense. Even in relation to that notion of the rules-based order, I think it would be highly simplistic to say that this flagrant violation of those rules means the end of those rules. Even in the midst of this terrible conflict, Ukraine took the time out to dedicate resources to a case before the International Court of Justice to discredit the legal arguments that Russia was putting forward, the spurious justifications, legal justifications that it was offering for its invasion of Ukraine. And I won't go into those, but we can talk about that. Those justifications were, if you'd like to. So even in relation to that fairly traditional, narrow view of the rules-based order, it is still structuring and informing what both parties, all parties, are doing. But I really think that that reductive notion of the rules-based order is highly out of date, and that what we see at work is an order shaping conduct and decision-making that is much more complex and much more multi-party, much more multipolar, distributed, if you like. And it's that order that is informing the various measures that have been taken in response to the invasion. Yes, we've had a UN General Assembly resolution, but we've also had a whole range of sanctions, and we can talk more about those, that speak to the financial order, the systems of cultural exchange and all the rules that facilitate that, and the continuous flow of goods and people around the world that is facilitated and structured by law and by rules. So the rules-based order is alive and well and very much active throughout this dispute.
Yeah, it seems to me if your test of whether the rules-based order exists or not is, does it prevent states from invading other states, then sure, there is no rules-based order. But if you're trying to understand more what's actually taking place beyond the armed conflict, you can't really understand it. And it's, you particularly can't understand Ukraine's response and the response of Ukraine's supporters without having some kind of idea of international law, of rules-based order, of norms, all these kinds of concepts. Would you agree with that?
Exactly. And the test that you suggest we set aside would be a nonsensical one to apply to any legal regime. We don't set criminal law to that. We don't say there's no criminal law because it's frequently violated. We don't say there's no tax law because it's frequently violated. So it doesn't really make any sense to subject international law to that test.
Yes. Yeah. It does strike me again and again how strange it is that that test is applied to international law to try and argue whether it exists or doesn't exist. But are there particular ways that Ukraine's response or the response of Ukraine's supporters has illuminated particular aspects of international law for you, the way that it's evolving and developing?
Well, I think one of the most significant measures taken by Russia's adversaries has been the freezing of assets held by the Russian Central Bank and its sovereign funds around the world, so some $630 billion that was held in foreign reserves is no longer accessible to Russia by virtue of sanctions adopted against the central bank. Although it still has access to about 13% of those reserves that are held in Chinese yuan, but it and also access to funds that are being used for energy payments. But the bulk of its foreign reserves, which it had amassed in part to kind of sanction-proof its economy, are no longer accessible to it because of not just the design of the sanctions that the US, the EU and Japan adopted, but also the enforcement mechanism that enables those sanctions to be feasible, which is really something that's built up over the last couple of decades, mainly in a counterterrorism and anti-money laundering setting, which involves elaborate monitoring of transactions at relatively small scale throughout the world at incredible volume and quite significant punishment of institutions that fail to implement those or uphold them. So that really speaks to the way in which this rules-based order has become reliant on all sorts of institutions that are not commonly thought of as maintaining peace and security in the world. And also it's indicates the interpenetration of public and private law, the way in which contract regimes and private law, including private financial transactions, are sites at which these kinds of issues are indirectly playing out. So I think it speaks to the more complex regime that is the rules-based order as it exists today, and other examples I could give as well.
Yeah, well, I'd love to come back to that. I mean, international sanctions really have been groundbreaking, and it seems to me they open many, many questions about international law, which we won't have time to get into today. But I would like to talk more about that a little bit later. But first, let's turn to the other way that Ukraine supporters are backing it, which is through the provision of lethal aid, I mean, including from Australia. So, Eve, my question to you is that sort of support making countries like Australia part of the war? Are we effectively at war with Russia because of the way we're backing Ukraine?
So, Ben, Australia's argument here would be that no, we're not. The law of neutrality, which is sort of an early 1900s concept crystallised in the early 1900s Hague regulations, would have, you know, made it clear that it's not possible for a third state to supply arms without being a party to the conflict. But the UN Charter and indeed state practice since then has made it clear that, you know, there are situations where supplying arms to another state would be an act that isn't in violation of the law of neutrality. And that is in particularly, of course, where the UN Security Council has agreed on that and declared a violation of the UN Charter and the violation on the use of force. Now, of course, we have a situation here where, Permanent 5 member is the aggressor state, and so we are not going to get that UN Security Council agreement on that. But, and this is definitely the subject of a fair bit of discussion and debate at the moment, but this idea that, a neutral state can't be bound by having to be strictly impartial when there is a victim state who is the victim of a clear violation of aggression is definitely something that is being discussed in this particular factual circumstance, which is not a circumstance that is going to arise with any regularity, because we are talking about just five states having this veto power. But where the UN Security Council isn't able to give this permission, there is, absolutely a suggestion that international law, because of the prohibition on the use of force, would allow states to do this. Now, of course, this does kind of raise the question that is being raised by lots of people about, well, what do past violations of international law mean for the current situation, and have the people of Ukraine, for example, been let down by the fact that in the past states have sought to manipulate the law to war in order to sort of justify their selective case. And so, when I think about this idea of sort of qualified neutrality, or the idea that it's okay in this circumstance because there is a clear act of aggression, then it does make you sort of think about the other international law arguments that have been put around allowing uses of force without UN Charter compliance. And so, for example, Kosovo, humanitarian intervention, Iraq and Afghanistan, situations where you didn't have a clear Security Council agreement. But I think in this case, when you're talking about the development of the law of neutrality, I think the fact that this development of the law of neutrality is in clear agreement with the UN Charter's prohibition on aggression does provide states like Australia and many other states who are supplying weapons to Ukraine with a clear legal argument that they're not parties to the conflict. That is not to say, however, that they don't have legal obligations in relation to the supply of those weapons. And, just to give a particular example, Australia has obligations under the Arms Trade Treaty, and they cannot supply arms if there is a serious risk that those arms will be used to violate international humanitarian law. So it's certainly not a free-for-all in terms of the transfer of those weapons.
So the law of neutrality would have made it impossible to get away with something like this before the passing of the UN Charter, but with the passing of the Charter, or adoption of the Charter, whatever the correct term is, it is possible for Ukraine supporters to say that they are still neutral at the same time as they're providing weapons. It's an argument, but from what I'm hearing from you, it's maybe not a completely settled argument, but it's a good argument, you're saying. Are there outer limits to what states that support Ukraine can do? I mean, I'm thinking in particular, it's clear that this conflict has a cyber dimension, probably a larger cyber dimension than we'll know about for a little while. Is that blurring the edges? Is it a very clear-cut distinction between what makes you a party, what makes you part of the conflict, and what keeps you neutral, or is it something where there is actually a grey zone?
Look, I think that there is definitely a grey zone, as is the case with much of international law. I mean, I would say in relation to, that distinction, when we're actually talking about the laws that apply in times of armed conflict rather than the law to armed conflict, there's a clear distinction. You have to be involved in the use of force, or if you're a sort of a third state and you are providing support to another state, there are absolutely thresholds that are involved. So those thresholds do create that grey zone that you're talking about. If we take the cyber, for example, and Australia has announced some cyber support to Ukraine, and it really is a question of, well, what is that support? Is that sort of the training support, or is that actually the doing support? And that seems to be the distinction, and certainly the distinction in international humanitarian law. If you put boots on the ground, you're clearly a part of the conflict. If you supply weapons and resources, then you're not. If you actually plan the operations, then you go over that threshold. And so if your cyber engagement is not just providing that sort of training support, but it's actually doing or guiding the operations and providing that operational support, then you're going over that threshold.
If Australia or the United States was providing specific targeting intelligence to Ukraine to enable it to hit particular targets, would that be crossing the line from neutrality into being a party to the conflict?
Yes. So if a state is actually providing that kind of support to direct the military operations, then that makes them involved in the conflict. It makes them a party to the conflict.
The other way that cyber has featured as part of this conflict we've seen recently is through suggestions coming from Washington that Moscow is contemplating large-scale cyber sabotage targeting US critical infrastructure in response to the Western sanctions that Vladimir Putin has described as an act akin to warfare. Fleur, you recently wrote in the Lowy Interpreter that national governments could only contemplate adopting the tailored sanctions that they've leveled against Russian elites and firms because sanctions compliance infrastructure has become globally ubiquitous. The sanctions compliance infrastructure has developed, but do we need more regulation and more control on the way that sanctions are being implemented? And does Vladimir Putin have a point, perhaps, when he says that sanctions like this are, in fact, akin to an act of warfare?
Yeah, thanks, Ben. I'd agree with your assessment that any claim that some sort of cyber attack on critical infrastructure was justified by international law is completely false. But sanctions, the broader point about the damage that can be done by sanctions and the difficulty of excluding civilian harm and causing great suffering among those who really don't deserve it in any kind of broader sense, is a legitimate concern and has been a concern for some time. There's a lot of talk of smart sanctions and targeted sanctions, and they have got much more refined, thanks in part to the infrastructure that I was alluding to in those remarks that you quoted from. But it's still very difficult to ensure that you target sanctions in a way that does impact the people that are intended to be targeted by them and minimalise their impact against others. And you cannot do that absolutely. I mean, these measures are going to cause harm not just in Russia, but throughout the global economy. And the decision has been taken. I think there's broad public support for the idea that it's worth taking that risk in this circumstance. But it's very difficult when you're doing this rapidly and on the fly to ensure measures of accountability and ways of questioning sanctions. And I think in terms of the type of regulation that is still needs to be built in, is regulation of that sort. So, for example, if you're some of the sanctions that have been adopted against shipping now apply not just to Russian flagged vessels, but Russian controlled vessels or vessels that are controlled or operated by persons connected with Russia. And you can imagine that's quite a vague category. And my understanding is that those charged with enforcing those, the shipping companies, are having a lot of difficulty figuring out how to apply it and who it applies to. And in earlier years of smart sanctions, there have been particular instances of individuals being caught up in a sanctions regime because they share a name, for instance, with someone who's identified on a targeted sanction, and really finding it incredibly difficult to extricate themselves from that regime. And a lot of my colleagues have written about this. Gavin Sullivan has done a great book called The Law of the List, which is focused on this and in relation to counterterrorism sanctions. But, and that book speaks to the kind of life experience of someone who finds themselves without any wrongdoing listed and can't conduct their life, can't travel, can't access any, can't do their work, and finds it very difficult to get themselves out of that system. It's almost like a sort of experience of identity theft in a way. And I think these kinds of problems are rife throughout this regime. And I think the next sort of phase of trying to make them smarter will be about having a public dialogue around what forms of compensation, what forms of remedy, what forms of questioning and investigation should be leveled against sanctions regimes to ensure or to minimise the likelihood that they will impact people who really aren't intended to be impacted by them and don't deserve it and wouldn't contribute to the enforcement objective anyway. And that's a work in progress. So I think when we talk about excluding seven banks from SWIFT or, you know, doing X or Y, it sounds like it's a very clean cut, but I think it's very, very messy, and there's lots of what in a military context is sometimes talked about of, you know, mistargeting or collateral damage, and we have a regime for that in relation to military force and military targeting. We don't really have a regime in relation to economic targeting or the direction of economic force, and in many respects that is, I mean, there's an element of truth in what Putin says, that is as harmful, which is precisely why states have done it. They are able to wield this force without having to engage a nuclear weapons holder directly in a military sense. So I'm grateful, you know, I think it's a good thing that we can deploy that countermeasure, that series of countermeasures, but they're not without harm and not without cost.
That's really fascinating, and it'll be really amazing to see, or interesting to see how that develops now, whether these new sanctions, which are breaking new ground, also bring some kind of response, some countervailing response in terms of a need for more norms, more exceptions, more accountability. Yeah, really, really interesting stuff. I'd like to turn back now more to Russia's conduct, Doug, though, and a question for you, Eve. President Biden has recently labeled Vladimir Putin a war criminal, and we now know that the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has opened an investigation into the situation in Ukraine. What are the prospects for accountability?
So, Ben, I think if people are looking for international criminal law to provide a sort of a short-term accountability or any kind of solution for the terrible suffering of those in Ukraine in the short term, clearly the prospects are not good. That's not what that part of the legal framework can do. But I think if you are talking about accountability down the track, and accountability in the sense that it will always be limited at international law by jurisdiction and the ability to actually bring people to trial who are beyond the jurisdiction of the international court, as you mentioned, but also other courts who may engage in arrests and indictments of those involved. If you take those things into consideration, then I actually think that the prospects are quite considerable for accountability in this particular case. It's clear that war crimes and other serious violations of the laws of armed conflict have been committed and continue to be committed. And as we know, the International Criminal Court is investigating this. The mandate of the International Criminal Court means that it will investigate and prosecute those most responsible for the most serious of crimes. It's never intended to be dealing with every crime that is committed in every conflict, and it doesn't have the jurisdiction to do so, even if it did have the resources or the reach. But this means that it's very likely that there will be indictments for high-ranking Russian officials coming forward. Now, of course, there are challenges in actually bringing those people to trial who are indicted, but an indictment of the International Criminal Court is significant, and it means that some 120 countries would have obligations to arrest anyone indicted by that court who came within their jurisdiction. And so whilst it's far from sort of a perfect solution, I'm not saying we're going to see heaps of trials of violators of international humanitarian law before the International Criminal Court from this conflict in the near future, but there is significance from an International Criminal Court indictment. And we also know that many other jurisdictions, there are briefs being prepared to investigate war crimes and the exercise of universal jurisdiction by a number of nations is quite likely. And also on the crime of aggression front, which, as we know, is outside the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court in this particular case, there have been calls by a number of very eminent international lawyers for a special tribunal on aggression. So I think it's fair to say that the international community is intending to use the extent of the international criminal law avenues available to them comprehensively in response to this aggression by Putin, and also in relation to the violations of international humanitarian law that are taking place during the conflict.
Thanks, Eve. Well, we've really just skimmed the surface, I think, of all the many ways that international law is engaged by this terrible conflict in Ukraine. But before finishing, I just wanted to ask you both if you had any further thoughts on how the conflict is changing international law, but perhaps more to the point, what role international law might play in ending the war, in a final settlement, perhaps, or even an interim one. Fleur?
So, Ben, I'll take the second half of that question in terms of the role that international law might play in ending the war. I think international legal argument will be part of the language that is going to be spoken by the negotiators and will be active in every relevant room. But just as importantly, international law is going to be central to thinking about what comes next. Even if, and I hope very much, this conflict comes to an end quite quickly, obviously the devastation wrought already and the influx of arms and people from many parts of the world, and the migration of the flight of so many people, raises all sorts of international legal issues that the world needs to direct its attention to, and international refugee law issues will be central, questions of international investment, questions of international organisational expansion, given that Ukraine is seeking access to NATO in particular, but also wanting other kinds of bilateral security and other arrangement to guarantee its future. So the international law is going to be very much at the heart of building an architecture post this war, and that is going to be a long and difficult process.
Thanks, Fleur. Eve, did you have any further thoughts before we finish?
Thanks, Ben. And yes, I mean, I think Fleur's reflections on the role of international law after the conflict are so incredibly important. And I guess I would just add to that, I suppose, the reminder that international law isn't a panacea. It's one tool in the toolbox that the international community has to respond. I think, although of course there have been challenges to international law in this particular situation related to, and as we discussed earlier, the fact that the aggressor is a P5 member, this is actually a situation where international law is really giving states a framework around which to unite their actions in support of the Ukrainian people and also in support of the broader maintenance of peace. So I think that the role of international law is that there are so many aspects to the role of international law, and that will be an important aspect of the end of the hostilities, which, as we say, we hope comes really soon. But there are so many different aspects of international law at play here, with the sanctions that Flair's talked about, the International Court of Justice application, the ICC investigation, General Assembly action, of course, and a range of actions that third states have taken in support. So international law does have a really, really big role to play. It's just not going to completely solve the situation by itself.
Fleur, Eve, thanks again for your time and insights. I've learned a lot. You've given me about 10 ideas for, I think, things that need to be written on and researched even more. Thanks again.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks for having us, Ben.
I'm Ben Scott. Thanks for joining me on the Lowy Institute's Rules-Based Order podcast. This podcast is part of the Rules-Based Order project, which is supported by the Department of Defence.